Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everybody, welcome to another seamless beginning of Murder in the Land of Oz.
Man, this show always goes off without a hitch.
Yeah, exactly. I'm Jess.
I'm Ellen.
And we're your hosts. We are currently on our South Australian season. If you're just joining us today, you should go back and listen to the older seasons because they're really good too.
Yeah, they're so high quality, especially our first couple of episodes where we really knew what we were doing.
Yeah, I actually have to say, I still think Alison Bennett Clay is one of our better episodes.
I think it's probably our best. It kind of is like a heart monitor after that. It's up and down. There are a few flat lines. Then there are like some spikes where you think that somebody's going to die. And indeed, lots of people do die. This is a murder show.
This is a murder podcast. Speaking of the murder of Alison Bennett Clay, some exciting news, guys, that happened on Monday. It was so fucking cool. I went to the the Ego Sciences building, and I got to meet Dr. Gordon Geimer, who was the botanist involved in he determined the six species of plants that were found in Alison Bennett Clay's hair. And we had a lovely subscriber, Jess. You can find her on Instagram at Green Thumbo. I have shouted her out before, but I actually shouted out the wrong name.
Savage.
Savage. Jess reached out to me and said that she worked with Dr. Geimer. So then I hurriedly organized some Botany Solves Crime t-shirts. And then, yeah, I got to deliver them in person to Jess and to Dr. Geimer. And it was very sweet. Dr. Geimer is as sweet as pie. I have a very cute photo of him holding up his shirt as we were sitting down having coffee. And Jess is beautiful too. Her partner also works, Ellen, I didn't get to tell you this. He works in like forensic data.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
Yeah, so she mentioned
what a power
that he,
couple.
Like, I know, right? What strength. Love that for them.
Yeah, amazing. So happy
so
for
she
them.
Exactly. She mentioned that her partner often flies out on cases and, yeah, and she's also just recently signed up to be a volunteer for the police as well. So that means I think she's still waiting to hear on like the selection process and stuff like that. But that basically means is that she is like bringing awareness to the community about like Crime Stoppers and stuff like that. And like doing like fighting the good fight and doing some really good stuff in the name of justice.
That's incredible. Jess is like the most amazing person I've never met.
I know. And she's stunning too, which is just, you know, she's just the full package.
Oh my God. Do you think she'll be
subscriber.
Like the third person on our show?
I don't know. Jess, let us know.
Yeah.
We've assembled like so many like ladies that have just been listening to this podcast. Some like men, stunning men too. But like
yeah,
a
but
lot of like really stunning people.
We have had like an outpouring of like incredibly talented, smart women who have like given us information like about cases that we didn't know or like offered like their services to us and things like that. And I'm like, damn, all these people are so much more like intelligent than we are.
I know we are. It makes us feel inferior, but
super
like
inadequate. Good, but also like very lucky.
Super inadequate. Yeah, exactly. No, we totally acknowledge how bloody stoked we are at like all the people that are listening. Speaking of, just to get negative, but we will get to the case in a second. But I've just got some beef. Literally, I have Musliman beef to my right, and also also some emotions. And we're getting a lot of reviews calling me shrill and saying that I shriek. I have to say, I am full of myself. I will own that. That was said in the review, and I do like the sound of my own voice. So I do listen back to episodes, and I don't actually think I shriek that much. So you're boring. You stop it, please.
Yeah. What he said? He said something. Well, we had some review. I'm assuming it's a he because I assume everybody who's critical about women. Anyway, I'm not going to continue with that. Yeah, he said, yeah, we sounded like a couple of immature teenagers that like the sound of our own voice. I hate the sound of my own voice. I'll state that publicly. Which is why I never listen to the podcast. But I do think it's important to make the point that we're not journalists. Like, nobody from the ABC or the Telegraph or the Australian are, you know, doing the research for us on this show so we can read it out for you. We do it all ourselves in our free time, and we're not experts, yeah. And we are just like friends who like to talk about true crime. And if that's not the kind of podcast you want to listen to, that's fine.
If you want to listen to Case File, do it. Yeah. It's a great time.
I do think it's a bit harsh to make such personal comments about us when we're just having fun, trying our best, living our lives. It doesn't need to get personal. It doesn't need to be mean. We don't mind if you don't listen to the podcast.
If you've got constructive criticism, or if you have facts that maybe we didn't get right, or you know, anything like that, like actual constructive criticism instead of just actually being negative about this. I mean, as I said to Ellen, and as I said to podcast producer Zane, if you look at the graphic of this podcast, it's pink.
Mm.
There is a unicorn on there. Ellen is wearing Minnie Mouse ears and drinking a Frappuccino. You won't see this from the photo, but the bag that I'm carrying on my right shoulder in this photo is actually a bag in the shape of a popcorn bucket. This is where we're at.
This is who we are. That's who's delivering this content. Let's keep our expectations low.
Exactly. We do what we do, and yeah. If you enjoy it, we're very happy to have you. Speaking of people that we're happy to have, we need to shout out some Patreons. Yay. And that's Graham and Regan.
Shout out to Graham. I messaged Graham and I have had a bit of a back and forth on the Patreon. He's such an awesome guy. Thank you so much for being a Patreon. And he said that he gave us a suggestion for an episode, and he said he'll be crying along with us as we cry. So thanks. Thank you for your manly tears, Graham. And shout out to Regan as well. Thank you for becoming a Patreon. We love you.
Thank you for joining the team. Helping us pay for our resources, which are coming in quick and fast, yes. Mates.
Yes.
Because we need to figure out, because obviously we're in South Australia now, yeah. So I assume we're going to go to WA next. Yeah. I love that we haven't, like...
Oh, nothing is planned out in advance.
No. What do you, no. So, yeah, then we need to figure out Northern Territory, obviously. If there's any in Canberra, I doubt it.
No, there is one. But, there's one I'm saving up.
Oh, yes. That's yes. No, you've told me about that Tizzy one. Yeah. And then we need to circle back, I guess.
Yeah.
Go to New Zealand.
Definitely New Zealand. We've gotten so many requests for New Zealand cases on the Patreon. I haven't decided whether or not they'll be Patreon onlys or if they will be full episodes yet. Oh, so if you want to hear some New Zealand stuff, maybe you'll have to become a Patreon. Or maybe you won't.
Or maybe you won't. Who knows? We haven't made our minds up yet.
We never do.
Because
what about the episode that's coming up in about 5 seconds, Jess?
Okay. So we're in South Australia, dolls. Now, this I actually remember to some extent.
Right.
So I don't think I remember the 1999 part of this case, but I definitely remember the 2001
right.
part of this case. So... tonight I'm going to be talking about a man called Mark Aaron Rust.
Mm-hmm.
So let's jet back. Let's take a time machine back to April 12th, 1999.
Yeah.
30-year-old Croatian immigrant Maja Jakic was walking along Paynham Road, which is about it's 5 kilometres northeast from the CBD of Adelaide. Her friends described her as quiet, polite. She mostly kept to herself. She didn't have many friends and she didn't mix well with a lot of people.
That sounds like me.
God. Her close friends and relatives thought that she might have been suffering from depression around this time as well. Ellen just choked on her water.
Sorry.
Everything is fine. 5 days later, on April 17th, 1999, a note was left on a patrol car, a police patrol car, that is, telling them that they would find a body at the disused Paynham police station. The body that was found in an advanced state of decomposition. Her jeans had been pulled down and her underwear removed. There was suggestion that they had been that she had been sexually assaulted and strangled, with her own clothing being used as a ligature. Dr. Ross James, who was the forensic pathologist from 1978 to 2002 in South Australia, was on the case. Because of the state of decomposition. Oh, good. Good. Yep. Thank you, Word document. Love that. Great. Because of the state of the decomposition with the body, it was determined they weren't able to determine who the Jane Doe was or indeed how long she had been dead. To establish the time of death, Dr. James needed the help of a forensic entomologist because of the insect activity on the body. Yikes. So basically, the forensic entomologist, Dr. James Wallman, who, if you could picture in your minds with us, ladies and gentlemen, what a forensic entomologist looks like, Dr. James Wallman looks exactly like that stereotype. Very clever. So he determined that the insect activity began on the body on the morning of the 13th of April, 1999, meaning that the victim had possibly been killed the night before, 5 days. So she, insect activity started on the 13th of April. She was found on the 17th. Mm-hmm. So she was most probably killed the evening of the 12th. So this was 5 days before the body had been found. There were no personal effects with the body, but the deceased had 3 missing teeth and gold restorations, meaning that it was likely that they would be able to identify her through dental
records.
She was described at 162 centimetres or 5 foot 4 inches tall, with shoulder length blonde hair. So being South Australia and what we've already talked about so far in this wonderful state, there were a few missing women around at that time.
I'm sure there was.
I'm sure there bloody was. But the defining features and the dental work, it was determined that the victim indeed was 30-year-old Croatian immigrant Maja Jakic. So Maja hadn't been since the 6th of April, which was 6 days before the entomologist had determined that she'd been killed. Police were trying to determine where she had been and who she had been seen with. I got a lot of this information from Forensic Investigation. I used to watch this show with my grandfather at the kitchen table. And this season, this might be when I remember watching it, was this episode. And Lisa McCune hosts it. So it must have been around the Blue Heelers time.
Yeah.
So on the Forensic Investigation, they spoke to Ida Gregov, who was a friend of a really, really good friend of Maja. And Ida talked about the days previous to the body being discovered and the identification of the body as Maja. She talked about speaking with Maya's mother, and she said that where Maja was found, Maya's mother actually would have walked past the empty police base a couple of times a day without even knowing that her daughter was lying there dead and covered in branches. So the police in the episode also talked about the more and more that they tried to look into what was going on with Maja at the time, the less that they were sort of coming up with. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in the lead up to her murder in the months previous described her at local shopping centres and stuff like that, but she was rarely seen with anybody. She was always on her own. Mm-hmm. When it came to the murder scene, there weren't any hairs, there weren't any fibres, but most importantly, there weren't any seminal fluids that could provide the investigators with a DNA sample to determine the identity of the killer. But they were pretty sure that there had been a sexual assault as well.
Just because of the way that she was found.
Yeah, exactly. And like with her pants pulled down and her underwear removed. Mm-hmm. Also what sort of like threw a spanner in the works was when this was – when the murder had occurred, there was an event in town called the Adelaide 500, which for the people who don't know stuff about cars, it's like the Indy, like the Gold Coast Indy. Like it's a big
car
racing thing. Yeah. So there were like people from all across.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people from all across the country, all across the world. So that meant like the suspect pool was like all of a sudden huge because it literally could have been anybody.
Did people really travel across the world to come to the Adelaide 500?
Well, like there could be like some tizzy car driver that people want to see.
Okay. Sure.
You never know.
I don't understand other people's hobbies.
I don't even understand mine, so it's all right. Here we are talking about murder at 7:30 on a Sunday evening. No worries.
Place to be.
Exactly. So as police were looking into the time that the entomologist and that the forensic pathologist had determined when Maya had been killed, they discovered a phone call had been made through to a police hotline and that had mentioned that someone was trying to break into the old Paynham police station. So obviously listening to the call, it's a bit sus. The operator is like on like the operator even on the phone, which you can listen to snippets of the calls in the Forensic Investigation TV show, which we will link in the show notes. You can tell that the operator is sort of like, you're sus. What's okay, cool, sounds great. Obviously this person like made themselves anonymous as well. They didn't say what their name was. So police obviously believed that the caller definitely knew more than what they were letting on. So an hour after the first call, so we're looking at 11:52 p.m. on the night of the 12th of April, another call came through to an ambulance hotline mentioning that they had seen a body at the old Paynham police station. So obviously, both of these calls were taken seriously by police and ambulance, and they went to the old Paynham police station and were looking around the property, but nothing was found, and the calls were deemed hoaxes. And then 5 days later, that's when the note appeared on the patrol car. But luckily, because the note on the patrol car said old Paynham police station, but luckily the people who read the note, instead of going to the old police station, they went to a patrol base.
Oh,
so it wasn't actually a police station, it was a patrol base. So that's where
the confusion came in.
So luckily they went to the police base and that's where they found Maya. The police, you know, determined that they thought that the note and the two phone calls were all connected and were all made by the person that committed the murder. Right. So the first phone call was made from a phone box because we're in 1999 and people didn't have
mobile phones.
A phone box which was literally like up the road from where Maya's body was discovered. And then the second was made at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, which is a fair ways away. So what police decided to do, and they hadn't done this before in South Australia, and I don't know if they had done much of it in Australia, I'd say it had probably been done overseas, but what they decided to do was actually release the hotline calls to the public so people could hear the voice, and if they recognized it, they could call the hotline and say, I think it's Ellen. Yeah.
Me? I was only 5. And in Queensland.
Yeah, God. Yeah. Unbloody likely, I'd say.
Yes.
So they released it on local news programs and, like, the news presenters literally started off the bulletin being like, look, police have asked us to release this audio. Listen carefully. They believe that this person has something to do with the murder of Maya Jackic. So a lot of calls came in, obviously, but there were no solid evidence to actually link anybody to anything because there were a lot of people being like, it was my neighbor, it was so-and-so, but not actually, like, there just wasn't anything for them to go on. Also, a $100,000 reward was posted for information into the murder of Maya, but once again, leads went cold. So police didn't really have anything to go on. So the case remained open, but it went cold. And it remained that way until 2 years later in 2001. And we move on to the disappearance of 18-year-old Japanese student Megumi Suzuki. So we're at Friday, August 3rd, 2001. Megumi is seen leaving her housing at 7:41 in the morning. She then headed to school at Amesbury College, where she was seen leaving at 3:08 p.m. Her last movements seen by people that she knew was that she was seen at Rundle Street Mall having coffee with some friends. And then the last of her friends that spoke to her told police that Megumi was getting on a bus and she was going back to where she was living. Anne Wearan was the international student advisor of Amesbury College, and she, after a few days, was a bit worried about Megumi. She didn't worry so much in the beginning because she knew that Megumi had like an on-again, off-again boyfriend, so she thought maybe Megumi had been staying with him. But she was getting a bit worried when Megumi didn't show back up for uni. So she contacted where Megumi was staying. And basically Megumi hadn't returned home after that day on Friday. So the bed looked like it hadn't been slept on. And the thing was, is that Friday when Megumi went missing was the night of the census. So everybody knows what a census is. You get counted and you have to like fill out this form and it's a whole tizzy thing. The census form was actually still on Megumi's bed and hadn't been filled out.
Right, so she's definitely not there.
She definitely wasn't there. So Anne obviously is concerned about Megumi, so she contacts Megumi's parents in Japan. Megumi's mother said to Anne that Megumi would never like leave anywhere for an extended period of time without her teddy bear, and her teddy bear was still sitting on the bed waiting for her, which made Anne immediately worry. Mm-hmm. So then Anne contacted Megumi's ex-boyfriend. So it's a little bit unclear of what this situation was, but I think that they, you know, had been together at some point, but they were still friends or something. So she contacted Megumi's ex and he said that he was also worried about her because he hadn't heard from her. Mm-hmm. After all these lines of inquiry, Anne was like, nope, okay, something's wrong. And then she contacted the police. So that was the following Thursday after Megumi went missing on the 3rd.
That was 6 days later?
Yeah. I think she was, yeah. I mean, look, I can kind of understand it with uni students and stuff like that, especially with the comings and goings. Yeah. Like, you never know. She could have been staying with friends, but I think Anne basically exhausted all of her contacts. She probably, I would say she would have talked to everybody because, like, if you think back to
2001,
then, and also like when you're a uni student, like probably would have been different for us, Ellen, because like you and I both lived at home when we studied. But if you're, you know, in a place that you don't really know,
and
you're staying in a college, like who knows, maybe she had a fight with somebody on the floor, so she wanted to go and stay with somebody else. Yeah. So I think, a bit.
No judgment to Anne.
Everything
that she could.
She did everything that she could.
But, you know, when those first couple of hours are so important.
It's so important. Exactly right. And also, it's probably that thing that Anne's heard over and over and over again of people being like, oh, well, they have to be missing for such
hours
and such.
Or whatever. Which is, you know, completely untrue in all jurisdictions.
Exactly. So Anne let police know the following Thursday after Megumi was last seen. So obviously, you've got a case of a missing student. Police weren't really sure if they were, you know, just dealing with a missing persons or, you know, God forbid that they were dealing with a homicide case. Mm-hmm. So then a man who actually worked along the busway where Megumi's bus went, he actually found her handbag. So in her handbag, her ID was present and her books. And, like, this was a really big indication to police that Megumi's disappearance was, you know, even more suspicious, like that there was something going on. So the 15th of August, helicopters and dog squads start searching around the area from where Megumi's bag was found. Her mobile phone wasn't found in her bag, and also Megumi used to carry around like a CD Walkman with her everywhere, and that wasn't present in her her bag. There was, however, her credit card and a bus ticket that indicated that her last movements were in the complete opposite direction from where she was living in her accommodation to a BP service station. So she had purchased a SIM card for her phone, and police were able to track her last calls and texts. The last message that she had sent was actually to her ex-boyfriend, who, funnily enough, lived a really close distance to the BP station. So police then obviously thought, okay, Megumi's gone to that side of town to go and see her ex-boyfriend, but she had never made it there. Her ex actually wasn't in the area at the time. He had an alibi. He was with a whole group of people, and police in this episode of Forensic Investigation were like, this guy did literally everything to provide us with information to help find Megumi. So they, you know, obviously they were probably like, look, you got to work from the inside out. Like, who do these people know? Like, you know, but they said, no, this guy wasn't in the area and he did everything to help find Megumi. And this is like yucky. So he actually had also come forward to police in the days after of him being investigated, because he had found in the area of where he was living a pair of underwear that he thought looked like they belonged to Megumi. So police went to Megumi's accommodation and they found underwear that were similar styles to the ones that were found. And the thing about Megumi's underwear, she's not a basic bitch like us. Her underwear was like majority matching.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so like she had her bloody shit together. So with the underwear that they found, they weren't able to find the matching bra.
Right.
But DNA testing was done on the underwear, and it was determined that they did belong to Megumi Suzuki. Oh. So this like creeped police out. It was like the underwear, much like the police. The patrol car note, like literally just like popping up out of nowhere. So police were obviously appealing to the public for help in looking for Megumi. They were handing out flyers everywhere, especially around like clubs and bars and karaoke bars that Megumi often went to. Her parents, Yoichi and Masako Suzuki, flew over from Japan and pleaded for their daughter to return home. They said, "We love our daughter very much. We pray that in the coming hours there will be some positive news." So now we're at the 18th of August 2001, when a member of the public actually reported that they had seen Megumi. And according to police, this person actually knew Megumi and was and knew her in regards to her accommodation and where she was staying. So dog squads and officers went around the area of where she was reported seeing, and they were interviewing residences and like going into houses trying to find like any trace of her. And unfortunately, they couldn't find her. So once again, Megumi's parents pleaded with her, saying, don't worry about anything. Mother and father will protect you from now on. Like, just...
Oh, God, my heart.
Yeah. So even with the sighting of Megumi and Megumi's parents' pleas and stuff like that, Megumi never came forward. So 8 weeks after Megumi had originally gone missing, police, because we're in 2001, it's early days of the internet as we know it, the police created this missing persons website. So as well as Megumi, Maya Jakic was featured on the site. And, you know, this was 2 years after Maya's murder. But police put the calls that were made from the hotlines up on the website, and this was for anyone to listen to see if that they could recognize the voice. And luckily, a man named Stephen Rust went on the website and listened to the voice and recognized the voice of his brother, Mark Aaron Rust. So Rust was born in 1965 in Adelaide. He began following women at the age of 13 and was first convicted of sexual offences in 1983. He would go on to be convicted of between 11 and 13 sexual offences between 1983 and 1999, including gross indecency and an unknown number of other offences, including arson and trespassing. In 1992, at the age of 27, he was diagnosed with Klinefelter syndrome, which is a condition found in men which is caused by having two or more X chromosomes. So Rust's physical symptoms included infertility, shrunken genitalia, sexual difficulties.
Right.
After his... Dr. Linda Papadopoulos stated that his sexual offending likely evolved out of the enjoyment he obtained from shocking others with his unusual physique, particularly his shriveled genitalia.
A psychic was like, ooh, I think this guy's fucked up.
In 2004, a psychiatric report stated that he found it thrilling to masturbate in front of pretty women, mainly due to the reaction it would provoke from his victim. So in June 1993, he was sent to prison for arson after he lit a fire in Kensington, which caused damage costing $642,000.
Oh, my God.
What? He was married twice.
That's just not fair. That's just twice. Not right.
Both marriages had failed. Anyway, so back to his good brother, Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
So Stephen continued to listen to the voice. Now, I'm not saying like this guy like heard it once and was like, that must be my brother, Mark. No, he's like, I listened to it half a dozen times. I stepped away from the computer. I went down the corridor of my house and I listened to the recording just to make sure that I could be sure that I thought it was him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something important. He was like, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Like, there's no damage done. Like, it's fine. But he's like, if I'm right, then the police needed to know.
Absolutely.
So at the time of Myers' murder, Stephen had actually been away from Adelaide for a few years. So he wasn't around for when the initial evidence of the phone calls was released to the public. So can we – I don't have siblings, but I can empathize with people – imagine listening to a voice and police are being like, hey, this voice is probably the guy that murdered this mm-hmm. woman. And I cannot imagine the dilemma inside Stephen Rust of being like the inner turmoil of like implicating your own brother in a murder of a young person. So obviously Mark was known to police.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen, to an extent, was aware of Mark's history with the police, but he didn't actually know that Mark had gotten violent with women. But he said in the interview, he was like, look, the family was sort of aware, but we just didn't think it was going to escalate.
To where it escalated
to. The point that it did. Yeah. So after talking with Stephen, police were convinced that the caller was Mark Rust, but that they didn't have enough evidence to make an arrest. Mm-hmm. So then once again, they turned to Stephen and were like, mate, we need a sample of Mark's handwriting to compare against the patrol note.
Right.
Patrol car note. So Glenn Smith, who was the forensic handwriting expert, once again, picture a forensic handwriting expert in your head. That's what Glenn looks like. Very clever, knows what he's talking about. So he noted from the sample that Mark, that he noticed the sample that Stephen Rust had given him of Mark's handwriting towards the and the patrol car note, that there was on the T's on both of the samples, there was like a double cross mm-hmm. on the T right, instead of just one. So like looking like a telephone pole instead of just one. And also like the spacing in some of the words, like good and look, the O's, like the G to the O, very, very, very close together. Mm-hmm. And like that was present on both of the samples. Glenn Smith was like, I am pretty sure that the person that wrote the patrol car note is the same person that wrote this other sample. Mm-hmm. So he was highly likely that it was
a match, basically.
It was a match.
The handwriting was
but
a match.
He did the scientific thing of him being like, I think, yeah. Not being like, I know. Yeah.
Not being like, it's fucking him, mate.
Yeah. So police felt that they had sufficient evidence to make an arrest in the murder of Maya Jakic. So when police actually went looking for Rust, he was already in jail.
Oh, how convenient for them.
How convenient. He had, it's so horrible, he had raped a woman at her workplace. But the reason that this woman survived the attack, fucking hell, this poor woman, is because she pretended to enjoy the encounter.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh.
You're a brave, brave woman. Yeah. Jesus
that
Christ.
That is a survival tactic.
That is like fight or flight. And to be honest, like, I don't think I'd have it in me.
No.
So mad props to you, doll. Like, fucking hell. So Mark was then arrested in regards to Maya Jakic. And he wasn't saying anything. Mm-hmm. But he did that typical thing of he got in prison and he found a fellow inmate and he confided in them.
Oh, classic. Little jailhouse snitch.
Yeah. And then the inmate was like, nah, I'm going to tell the police. Well, obviously not to him. But
he's like, nah, mate, I'm just going to go tell the police. That's how you get stabbed.
I'm just going to, yeah. So obviously he said nothing to police. He came forward to his friend and his friend said that Mark had seen this blonde woman on the side of the road. He accosted her and a struggle ensued. Mark was working on his taxi. Maya walked past and he asked her if she wanted a lift and she declined. And then he asked, how about a route? And she declined again and she walked and she was walking really, really fast to a nearby bus stop. So then Mark climbed inside his cab. He drove off and he parked at the Paynham patrol base. Maya was walking past. Mark then like dropped his pants and exposed himself to Maya. But Maya was like, she didn't laugh or like she didn't like, she wasn't horrified or like anything. She just laughed at him because, you know, how fucking ludicrous. Yeah. As Maya turned away, Mark Rust grabbed her from behind with his pants still around his ankles and tackled her to the ground. She was choked and then also strangled with her own clothing. So because of the information from this informant, police descended on Mark Rust's cell. And then something that they found in Mark's cell was a CD Walkman. That was, Ellen's reaction.
Oh my God, I'm freaking out.
Yeah, so they had found, they had a CD Walkman in his possessions that was similar in description to the one that belonged to Megumi Suzuki.
How could he have kept that and then be allowed to get into prison?
He's an idiot. So Megumi's mother was actually able to provide police with photos of the Walkman and serial numbers and they matched.
Oh, my God.
So the informant that went to police about Mark also had details of Rust's involvement in his possible involvement into the murder of Suzuki. He said that Mark approached Megumi at the BP station. He struggled with her. He raped her. And he told her not to look at him, but she turned around and she saw his face and he attempted to strangle her. But when that wasn't working, he proceeded to hit her in the head with a rock until she died.
Oh my God.
It was told to police that Megumi was killed on a vacant lot and that Rust had burnt her clothing and like paper and other stuff that was around was all like burnt on this vacant lot. So police went back to the BP service station where Megumi was last seen and directly across from it was a vacant lot. And at this part of the vacant lot, there was evidence of like a seat of a fire.
Right.
So then they called the fire department because obviously someone would report a random fire at a
vacant lot.
And the fire department said that, yeah, the night that Megumi was last seen, they had been called out to to put out this fire in the vacant lot. So in the remains of the fire, there was a rock that may or may not have been used in the murder. There was also some bits of burnt clothing and arm and bracelets, and they were similar in appearance to the ones that Megumi wore.
Okay, I'm not a police officer and I don't know how to investigate a crime, but I feel like if somebody went missing, like, near this BP, you do a 180, you see a vacant lot, you find out that there was a fire there around the same time. Like, I can't help but feel like some of these pieces should have fallen into place a little bit sooner.
Maybe, but I mean, you've got to think of, like, jurisdictions and stuff like that. Sometimes there's not a lot of communication between these things.
I don't know. It's frustrating that...
It's hard to know. It's hard to know because, like, from, like, my chats with my stepdad and stuff like that...
Who is a police officer.
And who worked homicide for a really, really, really long time. But, no, he doesn't tell me anything, ladies and gentlemen, because it's work, and also he doesn't want to talk about horrifying things when he comes home. You know, like... talking about different departments and how they work and, like, how people relate to one another and stuff like that. Stuff just slips through. And unfortunately, when it comes to work like this, people's lives are at stake. So, you know, it's like you put it in the context of, like, another workplace.
Yeah. It's just hard for my brain to accept that her body was, like, across from where they were looking for her this whole time. Or, you know, the remains of her body.
Oh, no. Her body. No. She wasn't burnt. She wasn't burnt.
What?
No. Nah.
Okay, maybe I...
strap in, mate.
How can this get worse?
Okay. So the only other information that they had on actually where Megumi's remains were is that Mark Rust had dumped Megumi into an industrial bin. So police were searching the area around the BP station to try and find a bin, and they found one. And they confirmed with the informant, and the informant said that there was an elephant or like a rhinoceros or a hippo or something on the bin, and that it matched the description of this bin. So obviously the evidence is like stacking high on Mark on the involvement in the suspected murder of Megumi, but a lot of this is still circumstantial because, you know, this informant could literally be making shit up or covering his own tracks or whatever. So they had to determine that the bin that they had found there's this weird bit where they said they were confirming it with the family. I didn't really understand why the Rusts would know. Anyway, so they confirmed that was the bin.
Mm-hmm.
So then Megumi's family flew back from Japan, and police described the Megumis having to, like, sit at this rubbish tip, like this dump, and watch police go through literally thousands of tons of rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
So she had been discarded in the bin and then sent to the tip almost like 4 months prior. So they found the level of the bales of rubbish that it was likely for her to be in. So then they had to, like, pull the bales out, break them apart, and then basically start searching in the bales to try and find her remains. So they were looking for things in the bales to make sure that they were on the right track. So you're looking at, like, newspapers to make sure, like, the date is around the same time, because then you don't want to be going further back or, like, further forward or anything like that. So they're looking at newspaper articles, bills, letters, just to ensure that they were around the time. Yeah. So on the 7th of December 2001, after 11 days of searching through tens of thousands of tons of rubbish, Megumi's body was found. God. So obviously there was a sense of relief that they had found her, but also, like, how did this 18-year-old girl get discarded in a fucking rubbish tip? Like, it makes me fucking violent.
Do you know how far away the bin was from the BP? When they say it was nearby, did they say how nearby?
Yeah, like within, like, it was like within a K or something.
Oh my God.
A couple of Ks. This, like, completely fucks me. So she still had clothes on. She was still wearing her boots, and the bra that she was found in matched the underwear that was found.
No way.
4 months previously.
That's incredible.
What the fuck? So the Suzuki said, "We are relieved that our daughter was found. Thanks to the efforts of everyone involved in her search, it was not an easy task. It was a miracle that she was found so quickly."
Straight up.
And Mark Rust was like, "Nah, I'm innocent." And he maintained that for a year.
That's just so unbelievable.
And then that year, the year later after Megumi had been found, he changed his plea to guilty. And Stephen Rust was like, "Stop this." Mm-hmm. He's like, "Do not put the families through this. Put your hand up and admit what you've done, because you have destroyed some fucking lives. Own what you have done." So after he pleaded guilty to the murder of Megumi Suzuki, Mark Rust also pleaded guilty in the case in the murder of Maya Jackich. So after Maya's murder, they had Maya's mother moved back to Croatia with the body of her daughter. And so they weren't able to, Maya's family weren't able to be here in Australia for the victim impact statements of when the sentencing and stuff like that was happening. Megumi Suzuki's family weren't able to attend the victim impact statements. But a sentence that I found from the impact statements that they sent were, "Can you feel a father's feelings that he will never again be called Papa?"
Oh, God. Oh, boy.
And then her mother also said, "It makes me insane when I think of her being treated like rubbish."
Seriously.
And then, yeah, seriously. And then Ida Grigov, who I talked about earlier, who was one of Maya's friends, spoke on behalf of Maya's mother, Jagoda Jelic, when she said, "Why would anyone want to kill Maya like an innocent bird and cover her with branches and cover his dirty crime?" So a suppression order was put on, preventing the media from naming the perpetrator of the murders, but it was lifted in May of 2003 after Russ pleaded guilty to two counts of murder and one count each of rape, assault and gross indecency. Justice Nyland subsequently sentenced him to life without parole for the murders and a concurrent sentence of 12 years for the other offences. He showed little remorse for his crimes. When asked why he killed Megumi Suzuki during psychiatric assessment, he replied, "Because I did." On September 22nd, 2014, Mark Rust applied to the court to have a non-parole period imposed on his sentence, which would allow him to apply for parole and potentially be released from prison once the non-parole period had expired. Parisian authorities opposed the request, stating that he was aggressive and abusive towards prison guards, although Rust denied these allegations. Rust's counsel claimed that his whole life term made his imprisonment particularly difficult for his mental health. I don't give a shit.
I have absolutely no sympathy for him.
As of November 2017, the application is ongoing. In addition to his custodial sentence, Rust is also subject to an indefinite detention order imposed because he was declared incapable of controlling his sexual urges. If he were made eligible for parole, the detention order would still prevent his release from prison.
Oh, good. So he's doubly in jail for life.
So that was the murders of Maya Jackich and Megumi Suzuki.
That had so many twists and turns and almost seemed like a story. Like the...
Yeah, it doesn't seem real, does it?
It seems like, you know, obviously we cover a lot of cases that have a lot of, like, you know, structure to them, but that very much seemed like a murder mystery. And I didn't like
Thank you, Forensic Investigation.
Yes, thank you, Forensic Investigation. I don't like how many cases we've covered where it's like, this man had a horrible history of raping and abusing women, but he was still allowed out in public.
Yeah, and we've brought this up before about the parole periods, especially in Victoria, because they did really have a big problem with parole and making sure that people stop doing this shit.
Yeah.
I want some harsher sentences for people that commit rape because they committed rape. Yeah. And also, they're going to do other shit. They're going to escalate, especially people like Mark Rust, who were incapable of controlling themselves. And when it didn't go their way and women were trying to fight back, he fucking murdered them.
The information was all there before a murder happened that he was not somebody that should have been out in public.
Be in public.
You know, the fact that sometimes, you know, in this case, in other cases we've covered, and in other cases across the world, that people get like 1, 2, 3, 4 year sentences for rape you know,
is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, you look at that guy, I don't even remember his name. The guy who murdered Jill Maher. Like, he had what? Like, yeah. 13, 15 previous charges against him for rape and assault.
In prison. You should be in prison for life for that. Not to sound like, you know, some tough-on-crime politician trying to get re-elected, but you should be in... If you violate another person like that, you should not only be going to prison for a couple of years.
That's the thing. It's violating.
It's such a serious crime that is just not treated seriously in the criminal justice system a large percent of the time.
But the thing that also drives me crazy about rape in general... Mm-hmm. is like, as soon as it happens, it's not like someone suffering, which is bad, people suffering from like a coward's punch or something. Like, immediately all the blame goes on, like when someone gets like punched or something like that, immediately it's like, oh, well, that person was a bully. Like, they, you know,
they committed
that
a murder.
That person's a murderer. Whereas like, when a rape happens, they're like, oh, well, what were you wearing? There what were you doing? Yeah, where were you? What time was it?
Circumstances for committing a rape. It's a crime. You know?
It's a fucking crime.
There is nothing that a victim does to warrant or to cause a crime like that. And, you know, two people could still be alive if that person was put in prison for as long as he should have been. And so many people... In general, even just in the cases we've covered, would still be alive if people were put in prison for the amount of time that they should have
exactly
been.
Right.
And that really, really angers me.
So yeah.
I've never heard of that. I did not remember that case at all.
I have, especially about Megumi, like as soon as I saw her photo again, I was like, yeah, I definitely remember this. I don't know, like these cases around like the late 90s, like early 2000s, like some of it's so visceral for me and I feel it like hitting me really hard because I just remember watching like programs about crimes at this time, like with my grandparents and stuff like that. Like this was the most formative time in my true crime obsession because then after that it was just suppressed for so long. So I feel like it was the same when I did what's his name in Melbourne?
Peter Dupas?
Yeah, Dupas. Like, as soon as I saw his photo, I was like, I totally remember that guy. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it just immediately hits me.
Yeah, well, I don't know what I was doing from 1999 to 2001 because I have no recollection.
So, yeah. Oh, duh. So, yeah, I've been sitting on that case of Maya and Megumi for a little while. I'm really glad I got to talk about it. I mean, two women who, you know, whose families entrusted that they were going to be safe. Like Maya came here as an immigrant and Megumi was here as a student. Like you hope that when you move countries that your children are going to be safe and happy. And for this to happen to them is absolutely despicable.
Yeah.
And Mark Rust is an evil piece of shit and will never be released from prison, hopefully.
Thank God.
And I am unbelievably proud of someone that I don't even know. And that's Stephen Rust of coming forward and making that really, really difficult decision of, you know, implicating his brother in this because he knew that it was the right thing to do. I think that was really brave and really wonderful. And it just goes to show the importance of missing persons websites and making sure that if you do know something about any, like any crime that's been committed, even if it seems so minuscule, it is so important for you to come forward.
Exactly.
It is so important.
Sharing,
no piece
sharing
of,
that information is so important because you never know who is going to see it. We recently shared
exactly
on our Facebook page about two girls who were missing. Some people said, like, why are you posting this? They haven't been murdered, which they weren't, and they were eventually found.
No.
But, you know,
thank
circulating God. That information, you know, if Stephen had been in the country or been in Adelaide at the time when those calls were first played on the news, who knows what could have happened, you know?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And I definitely didn't mean when I posted that article of the two girls missing, we definitely didn't want to imply that something horrible had happened to them. But Ellen and I have decided to, you know, if there are missing persons, that cases that come up that, you know, if we can share them on our Facebook and just get people recognizing the images, because you never know. You never know. So... Your turn in
yes,
a fortnight.
My turn.
Exciting. Very exciting. So then that puts us at three. So then we've got two more after that. Stunsville.
And then on to WA.
And then, yeah, WA. It's a big area.
So is that putting in your requests, folks?
Yes. Oh, my God. Also, Zane, podcast producer Zane, informed us tonight that we've hit 8,500 subscribers. I really want 2,000 because I'm a greedy bitch. Yeah,
at 10,000 we're going to do a giveaway or something special. So tell your friends.
Yeah, maybe email in some things you would like us to do for the 10,000 giveaway. No, we will not do a nude calendar, according to Ellen, and also according to me.
That was Jess's suggestion, and I just really don't find it on brand. But I mean, if enough people
definitely
ask,
not. You never know. But I do, Ellen and I have been talking about doing some, not nude photos, but just for some cool Mitlu photos soon. So we'll hopefully get those out. But yes, let's get to 10,000 subscribers. I feel like we deserve it. We work hard. I was up till midnight polishing this off last night, you know. Thank you all so much for listening. Your feedback, your engagement over Instagram and Facebook and our emails is amazing. I mean, if Jess hadn't reached out the other week and I got to do such a special, like, it was so sad that Ellen couldn't be there, but you know, she lives in Tasmania
now.
I was
like, it's fine. I hope you had a good day.
Getting to meet people like Dr. Geimer, who, you know, are fighting the good fight and are doing amazing things for criminal justice, and you know, it was an incredible moment. So the fact that shit like this is happening is so wild. And we're very happy and we're very grateful, and we can't wait to bring you more episodes. So please tell your friends and donate to us on Patreon if you want. We do have merch on TeePublic. Yes, Dr. Geimer is our official model for Botany Solves Crime. And he said that he said we're going to hook all the people up in the herbarium.
They're going to be looking
with Botany Solves Crime.
Very, very nice in their Botany Solves Crime shirts.
I just hope that they all get them in the different colours. I hope someone gets the burgundy. Yeah, be cute. Stunning. Well, thank you so much, guys. Hope you enjoyed it. Have a good day. Goodbye.
Bye.
So, what should I listen to now?
We are Castology. This is our podcast about podcasts. We are your castologists, Patrick Shearer,
Liz Best,
and Zainzi Weber.
Each week, we'll bring you three of the best and sometimes not so best podcasts around. We'll also do the hard work and trawl the RSS feeds to find the newest podcast that should be on your radar.
And then next week, we come back and tell you what we thought of the recommendations and bring three new sparkling podcasts to check out.
Now, will we always agree with each other's picks?
Probably not. But hey, you're clever. You know that's how reviews work.
We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcatcher of your choice.
That's Not Kind of Productions podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.